Okay, we can start. Yep. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Can everybody hear me? A bit closer. Okay. So for this afternoon's class, I just basically chose just a couple of three short suttas to read out and to just basically give my opinion on them. I'm not really a scholar when it comes to things like this, but I've been a Buddhist monk long enough, and I've surrounded myself with monks who are very learned in the suttas and dissecting it and finding the real, like, the meaning behind the words. But also, the suttas that I've chosen, they sort of like resonate with the way I think the practice goes. And it's just something that I would like to share with you. And I think, like with these classes or with the Dhamma, when you, from time to time, it's just nice to have a reminder. Because I think as practitioners, we actually know what the meaning is. But sometimes we just get, you know, lost in our lives doing things and we forget about it. And from time to time, it's just good to hear these things again. Like these suttas, I haven't actually seen them for a long time. So it's kind of nice. Anyway, so the first one is called Will, and it's translated by Ajahn Brahm. He's a word of the Buddha. And so it's basically about... It's quite a technical one because it goes through all the different different parts on the path when towards enlightenment. So it starts off with like virtuous behavior, and then it ends in liberation. So that's the beautiful thing about this path, I reckon, is because even though we are aiming for a lofty goal, we start off at the basics and we work from there, step by step. So, and the nice thing about this sutta is that it teaches us that these things happen like naturally according to our, you know, our efforts and also our karma. So it goes, you know, like meditators, which is meditators, monks, lay people, whoever wants to meditate, Buddhist. When one is virtuous, one does not need to will. Let me be free from regret. It is natural that one who is virtuous becomes free from regret. When one is free from regret, one does not need to will. Let me be happy. It is natural that one who is free from regret becomes happy. When one is happy, one does not need to will. Let me be joyful. It is natural that one who is virtuous becomes joyful. When one is joyful, one does not need to will. Let me be tranquil. It is natural that one who is joyful becomes tranquil. When one is tranquil, one does not need to will. Let me feel mental pleasure. It is natural that one who is tranquil experiences natural mental pleasure. When one experiences mental pleasure, one does not need to will. Let me enter jhana. It is natural that one who experiences mental pleasures enter jhana. When one has experienced jhana, one does not need to will. Let me see things as they really are. It is natural that one who has experienced jhana will see things as they truly are. When see things as they really are, one does not need to will. Let me experience nibbida and fading away. It is natural that one who is virtuous experiences nibbida and fading away. When one experiences nibbana and fading away, one does not need to will. Let me realize liberation. It is natural that one who experiences nibbida and fading away realizes liberation. Does anybody have any questions? So it's quite straightforward, and a nice simile that comes to mind is the one that Ajahn Chah taught when he spoke to the monks or the practitioners that went to Wat Pa Phong. He said that the Buddha planted a mango grove in the monastery, and all you got to do is just sit under the tree and the mangoes will fall by themselves. As I like, always like that, just the wisdom and the insight just coming by itself, like naturally. There's no need to like force your way to become enlightened. You know, like forcing your way to become enlightened, or forcing your way to like become a monk, or staying as a monk, kind of thing. You know, if you think about it. I was just talking to a few people and we were just talking about becoming a monk and how a lot of people like yourselves understand that it's probably the best thing to do is to become a monastic. Yeah, shave your head off, go live in the monastery, practice Buddhism. But there's something, I think there's, and we know that that's probably the best thing that we can do for ourselves, but there's something that's stopping us. Because I think, in a sense, we're not ready, or you know, this path is not right for us in this life. So maybe we have to wait for the next life. And this is what it means when like things, I think like things occur naturally and we can't control them. So we can't control them, yeah. And it's just always nice to, I think when I read this and just reflecting on the practice is you know, you just need to be at the beginning, just be a virtuous person. And just being virtuous, you don't need to like crave or want the next stage to arise. Because we understand in Buddhism like that craving and that wanting is actually stops us from getting to that next stage. So instead, we just be a virtuous person and just do that. And then you just allow things to mature, allow things to develop naturally. And then from like that virtuous behavior, you know, one becomes, as it says here, happy. Like no, first is no regret, like virtuous behavior, no regret. That's pretty straightforward. Like people who have regret if they do something wrong, they feel guilty. Say you go out and like there was a shooting down the road. I'm pretty sure the person who shot the other guy, out of anger, is now feeling a lot of regret, and that is because he's not acting from a virtuous place. So therefore, he feels regret. And that regret sort of like weighs on the mind, it troubles the mind. And you can see when the mind is troubled, you can't make progress on the path. So, when the mind is like free from that regret, free from guilt, things that you think you may be doing wrong, you know, that happens sometimes in a monastery. Oh, I had one piece of chocolate and then I had another one. I shouldn't have done that. The monk should be restrained. I'm feeling bad about myself. You know, so you can see that slows the process down. So being virtuous sort of clears the like say, sometimes the path is like you're stuck in a traffic jam. Being a virtuous person clears that traffic jam, so it allows you to move along the path a little bit easier. Okay. Okay, so one is free from regret. One does not need to will. Which is, I always like that line, one does not need to will. So one does not need to force it. One does not need to make it happen. And it's sort of like, you know, just in a sense, just be you when you practice, right? Just be you when you practice and allow Buddhism to take over. Instead of trying to be a Buddhist and try really hard, in a sense, it sort of feels like unnatural. And that does, I think, create, like, it puts stress on people. Oh, I've got to say the right thing. Oh, I can't be angry at anybody. Oh, so that's like sort of like the unnatural way of being a Buddhist. Instead, we're trying to be a Buddhist in a natural way. So in a sense, just be who you are. You have your character, your likes and dislikes, and just allow Buddhism to sort of overtake the bad traits in the mind. So when one is free from regret, one becomes happy. Yes, just become a happier person. Just become a happier person. I've known a lot of Buddhists for a long time, and I've understand where what kind of practice they kind of have, and I've noticed like the virtuous Buddhists, they're happy, you know. And they're not meditators or monks or whatever, but they just practice virtue, and you can see after many, many years the happiness that they get from it. But just imagine the happiness that they get from being a virtuous person if they decide to become a monk on that day. They might actually meditate well. Because as you all know, Ajahn Brahm's brand of like meditation is like the deep meditation comes from the happiness of the mind. Yeah. So when one is happy, one does not need to will. Let me be joyful. So these are all like positive states of mind that we can we understand in our own way. When one is joyful, one does not need to will. Let me be tranquil, pasadi. It is natural that one who is joyful becomes tranquil. And just remembering what I was taught long ago, this pasadi, when it comes to the meditation practice, is the like the tranquility of the body. The body becomes like when it meditates, so you don't really feel the aches and pains in the body. And you may all know that when you first start to meditate, there's always a little bit of aches and pains in the body. Like you might get a sore knee, a sore back, or sore something. And what this sutta is saying, that once the mind starts to become more happy, more joyful, that happiness and joy helps calm the body down. And then you become a person, when you're meditating, you don't feel so much pain or distractions from the body. Because I think when it comes to the meditation practice, where we're trying to sort of like, in a sense, just work with our minds. Like, the deeper stage is like, the mental happinesses of the mind and watching the breath and things like that. And if the pains of the body can get in the way and stop that progress from happening. So maybe if you're meditating, you get a sore knee or sore back. Instead of your mind just focusing on the object of the meditation, it'll be distracted by the bodily pains. So what this is saying is it gets to a point where the body just becomes calm naturally. Because I think there's some, is a hindrance for some meditators. It's one of these questions that people ask when they go and get interviews from the monks. How do I deal with pain? How do I deal with pain? So that's one of the reasons why When we teach the meditation here, we don't say, oh, just sit on the ground, or you've got to sit in full lotus, or in a certain posture. You can use a chair. You can use 5 cushions. You can lie on the ground. You should just get into a comfortable position so your body does not distract you in your meditation. Okay. So then, okay. So then after that, when the body is tranquil, one does not need to will. Let me feel mental pleasure. Sukha. It's like the pity, the sukha of the mind, the mental happiness of the mind. It is natural that one who is tranquil experiences mental pleasures. Does anybody know what mental pleasures are? Any questions, comments? So the mental pleasures of the mind. See. Huh? Good thoughts? No. Oh, you need the microphone. Huh?
No, is mental pleasure good thoughts?
No, I think when you look at this page and you see where we're at, we're sort of in the middle. So I think this is like the sukha, you know, you got the sukha here that arises within the mind, and then after the sukha you have the jhanas. So it's like the deep meditations, you know. So I think when you're entering the jhanas, the mind has to be quite still and quiet and peaceful before it gets there. So I think the stage of sukha is not about thinking. It's about an experience. It's an experience, yeah. You have a question at the back? No? Okay, no question. And yeah, so I'm not sure if this is correct or not, but you could ask Ajahn Brahm the next time you see him, but I think the sukha that you experience is like the beginning of the bliss stages of the deeper meditations. That's an interesting question to ask Ajahn Brahm. I would like to ask him that question one day. Yes?
Because you asked what are mental pleasures, yeah. You asked, and you said it was an experience.
Yes.
So I gather I wouldn't know what that is.
If you wouldn't know what it is. That, like, yeah.
You're saying, well, you're not really, I don't know. Can you say anything? It's not sensations, is it, in any way?
It's a mental, I think, it's That's a mental experience.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Also, is that related to bliss and emptiness? No?
Bliss and emptiness?
Yeah, when there's no thinking, this thing, then bliss arises. Bliss is like a, how do I say, good feeling, you know?
Yeah, the bliss is, I think like the happiness, the mental happiness that arises within the mind is something which is created in the mind. It's not something which is, I don't think, is felt on the body. Yeah. And I think it's like the beginning stages of like the bliss stages sort of like revealing themselves.
I thought you were saying bliss is when there's no more like much thinking, this thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the fit in that then arises.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah. Because I spoke to Ajahn Brahm and he says that the reason why the bliss stages, they start to arise is because there's more stillness being developed in the mind. And it just grows and grows and grows. Yeah. So this is like from the happiness of the mind, then you enter like the deep meditations. Yeah. And it's just all happens naturally. You don't have to force it. Every time you go in and see Ajahn Brahm, oh, Ajahn Brahm, what do I do next? And he says, no, that's the wrong question to ask. You don't do anything next. You do nothing. You just stay in the present moment, whatever object you're on, and then allow the mind to develop from there. Yeah. Microphone.
Just a question on the bliss and that is mental.
Yeah.
That would have to pass down through into the body.
It's
have the bliss not only mentally but physically as well. Surely.
I don't know about that. Yeah. You do hear about people having like waves of bliss and things like that going through their body. And sometimes the meditation teachers say that that's a form of like piti sukha arising in the mind. But I think, I don't know if I'm right or not, but I think Ajahn Brahm says, yeah, that's the one, like the one form of piti sukha that can arise within the practice. But he encourages us to focus on the piti sukha that arises from within the mind. Yes, Eddie.
Is bliss the good feeling, you know, somewhere in the chest, you know, the thing?
No,
or how would you describe that bliss?
I think like the good feeling in the chest, and you know, love the world kind of thing. being a hippie and just walking in the fields of beautiful flowers. That's more of like a kindness, or more of a metta kind of thing. But I think this bliss that we're talking about now is the bliss of the mind. The mind gets stronger and more powerful through the practice of meditation.
So bliss is not a feeling then?
It's a mental thing. It's hard to describe because it's a mental thing. Huh?
Mind over matter? No. Mind over matter?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a good question to ask Ajahn Brahm. Is like the piti sukha, happiness of the mind, is that the beginning? Like, is the bliss from that the beginning stages of like the deeper meditations? I haven't had a chance to ask him that question, but I think it could be quite accurate. Yeah. Any more comments, questions? Yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
I would like to know what is being virtuous. Is it the noble path? What is virtuous? Being virtuous, because it starts out being virtuous, being yourself.
Being a pure-hearted person, somebody who's harmless, someone who doesn't fault find, easygoing kind of thing. Somebody who cares about other people. Yeah. And also I think like being kind to yourself as well. Because the Buddha did talk about the middle way. Yeah. And basically when you think about our lives as a monk, it's sort of like split into two. You can either, Ajahn Brahm talks about service or meditation. So like virtuous, I think like works both ways. So being a virtuous person, you help others, but you help yourself as well. So you help yourself by being kind to yourself, like not giving yourself a hard time. Like if you take that second piece of chocolate as a monk, you're not gonna and then you're not gonna put yourself in a prison. Because or just like, you know, just resting the mind, having a nap, just being kind to yourself, just allowing those the natural energies of the mind to just arise. Sometimes I think we stress out too much, we get too tired, and because of that our moods change. Yeah. In the mornings people are like, oh, I don't want to do anything, I'm too lazy. Because it's morning time, you're tired. But after three coffees, you're okay. You know what I mean, right? And then when your mind's a little bit awake, it's a little bit rested, you know, you feel good, you're happier. Yeah. And I think that's always like the case with like the meditation practice Ajahn Brahm always taught us to just, we have to learn ourselves. He gives us a hut to live in the forest, and we just learn how to work with our own minds. And one of the things I've learned is when you're meditating, it's good to have a rested mind before you meditate, because there's no point struggling with like tiredness and sleepiness. And then when you're tired, you're struggling with that, and then you get upset, you start to develop ill will. So we have to learn how to be kind to ourselves, rest our bodies and our minds, so when we meditate, it becomes easier. Yeah. Like being virtuous is just being like kind to people, I think, and not causing conflicts. So you create like a peaceful and nice environment. That's like, Ajahn Brahm talks about that a lot in the monastery these days, is just living a virtuous life amongst the monastics. So you don't have that burden of being in a conflict or getting angry or fault-finding with other people. And that's just like another burden that you don't have to deal with. Yeah. But yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I think you can tell, like, if you're stressing yourself out too much, then you're not looking after yourself. Yeah. And it comes from like thinking negatively or in the wrong way. Mm. And sometimes I've known this monk for a very, very long time, and the one thing that came across from his behavior was, he was very good at using his thoughts to create more positive thoughts. So in a sense, he had like positive perceptions, like about life and about people and things like that. Until it got to a point where, you know, it was it was a bit too much. But this is him in the earliest stages, like of his monastic life, just having that positivity, even though it may not be there. And then after many, many years of just training his mind in that direction, it just changed his person. He's like he's now just like a genuinely like good, virtuous person. And that came from just changing the way he thought. Yeah. Okay, So when one experiences the jhanas, one does not need to will. Let me see things as they really are. It is natural that one who experiences jhana will see things as they truly are. When one sees things as they really are, one does not need to will. Let me experience nibbida and fading away. It is natural that one who is virtuous experiences nibbida and fading away. When one experiences nibbida and fading away, one does not need to will. Let me realize liberation. It is natural that one who experiences nibbida and fading away realizes liberation. So these are like the last three paragraphs. You could say that's like developing the deep meditations in order to get the insights into the Dhamma. And this all happens like naturally. You don't have to think too much about it. And a good example is a monk was talking to me, and he told me that he got like deep insights into the Dhamma before like he started to read the suttas. And that's what he said to me. And I said to him, if you were to read the suttas, how would that affect your practice? And this monk told me that maybe if he read the suttas beforehand, then he would have probably gotten to the realization realization of the Dhamma a lot quicker. So you know, when I heard this, I was thinking, this person is a great meditator, he's a good meditator, and then from that meditation, even though he didn't have a really deep, I'm sure he understood the suttas to a certain extent, but he didn't have a extensive knowledge of the suttas, but he had the deep meditations, and from those deep meditations, naturally, the insights they arise. That's a beautiful thing. It's like you just allow things to naturally happen. I've been a monk for a while, and I've gotten to the stage where, you know, I'm really not really chasing the deep meditations, the enlightenments anymore. As a young monk, I was, and over the years, just build like a level of contentment, and you're just happy to be where you are, and you just continue the practice, and then just allow things to happen naturally. If I become enlightened in this life, great. If I don't, I have another life, in my next life. There's a kind of outlook that I have now. So just knowing that, you know, these things happen naturally, we don't need to be too worried about the future. Yeah. Okay, any questions, comments? So this is a nice, like, what is it? Nibbida fading away, one sort of, yeah, what is it? Like revulsion to the world. One is not really interested in the world again. And I think that's what happened with the Buddha when he became enlightened. He had nibbida towards the world, and he thought that this Dhamma was maybe too difficult for people to understand. And he was willing to die. Yeah, because he had no interest. But then, I think in the tales of the Buddha, a deva came and spoke to him and told him that there's people who's out in the world would understand this Dhamma. So then the Buddha used his psychic powers and surveyed the world and found people who would understand, and he went to teach them. And they also too realized enlightenment. But you can see, you know, you get to a point where you don't want anything to do with this world. And this is what it means when it's like, you know, nibbida, a revulsion to the world. And then when you don't want anything to do with this world, like the fading away. I think the fading away is like these, you know, these cravings, these delusions, the hatred, the ill will, you know, that disappears. Until you become a person with no ill will and no craving and no delusion. That's a wonderful thing, you know. Can you imagine that? Don't have to worry about your health anymore. Don't worry, have to worry about the CBSW, the BSWA anymore. You know, that kind of thing, yeah. Okay, I think we'll move on. I think, can we move on to number 35? The third one. I might skip the second one. Pretty much the same thing. So this is about, I think I like this sutta because it talks about how peaceful a developed mind can be and how troublesome a undeveloped mind can be. Yeah. So it's a story about the Buddha who's sleeping in the forest. So, so this is this translation was done by Ajahn Sujato. Yeah. So, apparently he's translated all the suttas, except for the minor ones. Yeah. And you can check it out on Sutta Central. Give him a plug. Sutta Central. Okay. Okay. So, so I have heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Alavi on a mat of leaves by a cow path in a grove of Indian rosewood. Then, as Hataka of Alavi was going for a walk, he saw the Buddha sitting on that mat of leaves. He went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side and said, Sir, I trust the Buddha slept well. And the Buddha said, Yes, Prince. How would the Buddha sound? Yes, Prince, I slept well. I am one who sleep well in the world. So yes, and it goes on to describe. So the is it Hataka says, the winter nights are cold, sir, and it's the week of midwinter when the snow falls. Rough is the ground trampled under cows' hooves, and thin is the mat of leaves. The leaves are sparse on the trees, the ochre robes are cold, and the cold blows the north wind. And yet the Buddha says, Yes, Prince, I slept well. I am one of those who sleep well in the world. So yeah, can you imagine that? Out in the wind, out in the cold, just these brown robes. I don't think I could sleep. But the Buddha could. And later on it explains in the suttas why he could sleep in such difficult conditions. And that's a really nice thing, I think. Okay, and then he went on to say, Well then, Prince, I'll ask you about this in return, and you can answer as you like. What do you think? Take the case of a householder or his son who lives in a bungalow plastered inside and out, draft-free, with latches fastened and windows shuttered. His couch is spread with woolen covers, shag piles, pure white, or embroidered with flowers, and spread with a finer deer hide. It has a canopy above and red pillows at ends. An oil lamp is burning there, while his four wives attend him in all manner of agreeable ways. What do you think, Prince? Would he sleep well or not? Or how do you see this? So what does the prince say? He would sleep well, sir. Of those who sleep well in the world, he would be one. So I think the young prince is of the idea that you have money, you have a nice house, you have all the agreeable things in the world, and because your material needs have been fulfilled, it is easy for you to sleep. But the Buddha is going to rebut him. Because the Buddha is all about not material things, but all things mental. Okay. What do you think, Prince? Is it not possible that a fever born of greed, physical or mental, might arise in that householder or householder's son, burning him so he sleeps badly? So he's talking about, you know, the anxieties that we may have or the depressions and things like that. Yes, you know, a lot of people can't sleep because of these things. So this is what the Buddha is talking about. And the prince says, yes, sir. So he understands what the Buddha is saying. So the greed that burns that householder or householder's son, making them sleep badly, has been cut off at the root by the realized one, made like a palm stump, obliterated and unable to arise in the future. That is why I sleep well. So that's what I like about the sutta, as a Buddhist following this path, we can train our minds to become like peaceful and calm and content, and we can find ourselves in any situation, and we can just sort of flow with it, and yeah. And the Buddha had such a powerful mind that he didn't need much to survive. He didn't need much to go to sleep. He didn't need a house or a sleeping bag or anything comfortable because he had a comfortable mind. That's a really nice thing. Any questions, comments? Oh, Eddie, yes.
Talking about the Buddha's sleep, you know. Talking about the Buddha's sleep, you know, okay?
Yeah.
What I understand is the Buddha only sleeps 1 hour a night. Is that true? Because he's so peaceful. You know, for us human beings, we need that 8 hour, you know, after, you know, sleep to recuperate. He only needs 1 hour, and then he was saying that the devas or what, they come to talk to him in the
yeah, I don't know
night.
Where you come from.
Is it yeah. yeah, all these things?
Yeah, he teaches at night and all these kinds of things. Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah, but it's understood that if the meditation is going well, you don't need much sleep because the mind is bright and is energized. Yeah. Yeah. So instead of the usual 8 hours that the was it doctors recommend, you just end up sleeping less. Yeah.
Physical pain.
Oh, physical pain. Yes, yes.
Why is it greed rather than like hatred or ill will?
I didn't actually think about that. Physical, mental. I have no idea. When you talk about the physical pain from anger, what do you mean? Like just the burning of the, just like having angry thoughts and then the body sort of feels uncomfortable? Or someone getting angry and hitting somebody, so then you get hurt? Yeah, I don't know. It's really what is it? It's there isn't much description here on why the Buddha said that, but yeah.
I wonder why that manifests physically like that. That's just my question.
I have no idea. Yeah. But I think the main point the Buddha is trying to make here is that when the mind is agitated, then it's not peaceful anymore. So it's hard for it to like fall asleep. Yeah.
So what comes first? Is it physically in sleep such as this? Is it unrestfulness physically and then manifests mentally,
or the other way around, mentally, and then affects the physical, or is it both ways?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's like, you know, when you have like maybe you're having a restless mind when you're trying to sleep, so then you start to toss and turn, and then you try to, like, you know, not think about it, and then you calm down, but you can't go to sleep, and then you sort of start to crave more sleep, and then you start to toss and turn and things like that. But I think it's more of just the worries that human beings have, who have not given up the world as the Buddha did, say, just like your everyday people who worry about the future. How am I going to pay my bills, or you know things like that, just like mundane things that keep people up at night. Yeah, I think the Buddha is telling this person, if you have a mind which is, it doesn't mean that it's completely free of like greed, hatred and delusion, but it's learn how to let go to a certain extent, and the mind does become just, you know, that little bit more still, a little bit more peaceful. So then it makes it easier for you to go to sleep. Yeah. I don't know. Hey, I'm sorry. I don't know the Pali. It's just Ajahn Sujato's translation. Yeah. Yeah, Eddie?
I just enjoy it.
yeah, go for it. Interaction with the crowd.
No, in Buddhism, greed, hatred and delusion, the Buddha says these are the three poisons, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's like, if you inhale this poison, then probably we start with having disturbing feelings, disturbing emotions.
Yeah.
Then if it's too long, it might go to the system and then get then pain arise.
I think it's just I think it's just like, just to be able to function like productively or with like a sense of like mental well-being, one needs to have that lack of greed, hatred and delusion in the mind. So one can sort of like live more in the moment. And one can, you can, when you start living more in the moment, you can, I think, react accordingly to the situation. But if your mind is filled with like greed, hatred and delusion, then you're sort of like moving around the world in a cloud. You don't really know what you're doing, you know. You sort of bump into a wall or something like that. So that clarity of mind is actually allows you to, I think, act wisely in every situation that you're in. Yeah. And allows for like the growth of the spiritual path to happen. Because if you have too much greed, too much hatred and delusion, then you don't really grow that much on the spiritual path. Yeah, I think anyways.
Any more questions, comments?
Any questions from the internet? Yeah, we just answered a question from the internet. No, it's not the end. It's coming close. I really like the sutta, yeah. One of the things that I like the sutta is that you read it and you just have your own interpretation of it. And it makes sense, yeah. It comes from the Anguttara Nikaya. Yeah. I'll just finish this one. Okay, we're almost finished. We're almost finished. Yeah, so the Buddha was talking about the reason why he could handle such harsh conditions and be peaceful and calm. Wherever he goes is because he's like become enlightened. So what do you think, Prince? Is it not possible that a fever born of hate or a fever born of delusion, physical or mental? Yeah, that's a good point, physical or mental. These things are usually mental, I think. I don't know where the physical comes from. That's a good find. Might arise in that householder or householder's son, burning him so he sleeps badly. Yes, sir. The delusion that burns that householder or householder's son, making them sleep badly, has been cut off at the root by the realized one, the Buddha, made like a palm stump, obliterated and unable to arise in the future. That's why I sleep well. He was just saying that it's not only in sleep but just every day, just like function, like how you function in the world. Yeah. Like these like negative mental states stop you from functioning like correctly and or like rightly in the world. Yeah. And also takes away a lot of the peace and happiness that you wish to develop as people. Yeah. Okay, and then he goes off and has a little poem here. A Brahmin who is fully extinguished always sleeps well. Sensual pleasures slide off them. They're cooled, freed of attachments. Since they've cut off all clinging and removed the stress from the heart, the peaceful sleep well, abiding in peace of mind. Any comments or questions? Okay. Oh, fully extinguished. It's like fully enlightened. Like no greed, hatred and delusion. No greed, hatred and delusion. So you don't get reborn. You don't suffer. Yeah. What is it? What does Sariputta say? He said, to reborn is suffering. To not get reborn is happiness. So being like extinguished, I think it's quite challenging, because sometimes when I hear, you know, the teachings of non-self, and you get to a point where there's nothing left, there's no you, there's no life, there's no existence, it's quite scary actually. Yeah, can you imagine not being here? Not being able to breathe? Not being able to form a thought and have your opinion. It's all very nice, yes, enlightenment, but when you think about it and these monks describe it, there is nothing left. But I guess when you develop, my logic tells me, when you develop the path, the more deeper you get, the more you understand that this life that we live is not worth holding on to. And that comes from the wisdom developed from the deep meditations. So when it gets to that point where you have to let go of most things to become enlightened, you'll have that understanding or willingness to do so. Because it said, like in the first sutta that I was reading, before the enlightenment, you start to have like revulsion or repulsion towards the world. And a good way of describing it is like having two magnets, but like separate sides try to push together and they just come apart. And that's sort of like you and the world. There's no more like wanting to be attached to the world again. And then when that starts to happen, then the after that, you become enlightened. Boom, 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 boom. Sorry, I shouldn't have too much fun. It's a class. Yeah, that's what I thought too. I was talking to Apamana about it, and the word revulsion, when you use it in like today's society, there's a negative like emotion behind it. But then he told me it's like two magnets put together. So maybe that's not an accurate word, but it's a word that Ajahn Brahm likes to use. Disenchantment, yeah. Just not really wanting to like get involved. Because it's sort of kind of strange. If you're like repulsed by the world, then we always talk about the happiness that comes from the practice. So it doesn't really link up there, but I think there's a word that they use that one does not really want to get too involved in the world again. Yeah, and they step away from it. Okay. Any more comments, questions? Yes, Eddie.
See, in the sutta, the Buddha was talking to this man, okay?
Yeah.
So the thing is, he's talking about like a lay person who's got greed, hatred, delusion.
Yeah.
Then they can't sleep well. A lay person who has like a minimum greed, hatred, delusion, he can sleep well too.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was talking about a Brahmin, you know. Talking about like monks and all these things, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a two distinct, you know.
Yeah, the Brahmin is sort of like, I think he's talking about a practitioner.
Practitioner. Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're Brahmin or Sakyan or whatever else they have in those. In the
so Brahmin as long as you have peace of mind, okay, for a lay person also, middle way comes into, you know.
Yeah, the middle way.
Yeah, I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think when you talk about the sleep, it's not only sleep, it's like other aspects of your life. Life becomes easier if you look a little bit more into the sutta. Not only sleep becomes easier, but life becomes easier.
Yeah.
Dealing with people, meditation, being a virtuous person, it becomes easier.
So he's not saying that lay people can't sleep well. He's talking about the Brahmin, sensual pleasures slide off them, you know, like monks But for lay people, we still have sensual pleasures, you know.
Yeah.
So if we have, we don't, as long as we don't overindulge, you know,
Whether you're a monk or whether you're a layperson, if you're unenlightened, you still have some sort of pleasure.
Yeah.
Sexual pleasure.
Yeah. As long as you don't overindulge, you feel your, then you can sleep
Middle way. Yeah. But then you need have a bit of self-awareness to understand whether you're overindulging or not.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Be aware of everything. Yeah. Thank you.
Metta, that's right, yeah, the Metta Sutta, it's always a nice one, isn't it? there's just so much, the Buddha spoke a lot, hey, if you think about all the books that have been written, about the word of the Buddha. Okay, I'll just answer these questions and then we can finish off. Okay, from America, how do you train yourself to find value in negative experiences? Interesting question. If you can give me more of a few examples, then maybe I can help you answer the question. But I think with negative experiences, I don't know, maybe a trauma or something like that, these things don't these things don't last forever. They come and they go. So just understanding that, yeah, you're going to suffer a little bit, then you can just move on after that suffering has passed and just live life again, enjoy it, kind of thing. Yeah. You know, I'm sure, you know, this Buddhist center, even though we're Buddhists, I'm sure there's been some negative experiences. They come and they go. They don't really happen very often, which is a nice thing because we're training ourselves in the right direction. But then when they disappear, they disappear and just move on. And then what you learn is try not to do it again. And just try to understand, how you've acted or how somebody's acted has hurt the other person. And just learn from that experience. Huh? What?
Agreed.
Yeah, learn from it, yeah. Okay. How do you kindly stand up for yourself against ill will? It's easier to do it in your mind than in real life. I think with standing up for yourself, sometimes it has to do with the type of personality that you have. Some people are more willing to stand up for themselves and because of their personality type, and some people are more like passive and they just hold things in and things like that. Yeah. But then it'll get to the point where I think if a person's ill will is actually causing you too much trouble, then you have a reason to stand up for yourself. You can't be like a doormat or a punching bag and let people hurt you in life. It gets to a point where you stand up for yourself and just tell them, you know, to just back off. You know, this, you don't want to be... like you don't want to be like exposed to like this ill will. And I think once you tell them, sometimes people don't realize that they're causing you any harm, so they just keep on going and doing and going and doing it. But then once you tell them, it sort of wakes them up, and then they wake up and they start to think how they've been acting, whether they've been acting in the right way or wrong way, and then from that they can correct their behavior. But if they're like, if they don't correct their behavior, and if they're a person that picks on you and causing you a lot of stress and turmoil, then just avoid that person. You know, you don't need to be around them. Yeah. And I've noticed that in my life. You know, sometimes when you have trouble with somebody, when you see them, right, things come, you know, whatever stress or whatever just arises in your mind. But when that person disappears, that stress and that like anxiety or whatever disappears. So sort of like in the same way, you know, you don't need to expose yourself to these kinds of people. You can actually move away from them, and it's actually better for your mental health. And there's sort of the reason why I say it is because maybe we're not like developed spiritually enough or have that, you know, that inside or inner strength to be able to deal with people like this. So in a sense, we have to work on ourselves and develop like more peace, just more wisdom, yeah. And then we can later deal with these people in a manner where it doesn't cause us too much trouble. Yep. Dun, dun, dun. Okay. Good? Good. Great. No worries. All right. We will pay respects to the Buddha. ice cream truck.